Good morning. Welcome to Radioactivity. I'm Rob Loride. Coming up in a moment, all the Democrats' hopes and dreams of doing something major in Washington, D.C., now that Joe Biden is president, all are wrapped up in the filibuster. And we're going to talk about the history of the filibuster and how it's used and misused in just a moment. And then later on in the program, we'll open up the phone lines and take your phone calls. But first, two listener comments about yesterday's program. Yesterday, we heard some discussion about the Publix heir who donated to the protests that led to the insurrection at the Capitol. And also, we're going to hear about a comment about our guest yesterday. Our guest was discussing his new book on what we can do to prepare for climate change. And here's what two listeners had to say.
My name is John. I'm calling regarding the Publix heiress who donated $300,000 towards the protest and insurrection. I think the total that was raised was $500,000. My question is, what was that money used for? Was it to pay the participants? Was it used for travel? Was it to buy some of the gear that they had? I've yet to hear any details of how the money was distributed, and I think that would be key. And I wonder if Jenkins can be indicted as a co-conspirator in that effort. Just two questions I had. Thanks.
Just want to make a comment about yesterday's program and the guest that you had on about climate change. It was very interesting, but there was I wish he was on so that we could ask him or at least pose some questions to him. One is when you mentioned reducing our personal energy consumption by, like, changing out light bulbs, and he kind of scuffed it and said, oh, well, that's, you know, very insignificant that, you know, most of our power usage is somewhere else. And I don't go along with that. I think if we reduce our power, that the power on the other end is going to be reduced. And then he talked about infrastructure, how we're going to adapt. And it's, you know, like concrete takes so much energy to create and to build this infrastructure. And I think it's more of the same that we're trying to, you know, circumvent nature and say, well, this is, you know, our human needs are this, and we're just going to change nature, when in reality we have to kind of start looking at nature and say, well, we have to mimic this and learn how to live with nature. And of course, the last point was kind of, we hear it all the time about how animals are belching and farting and creating, you know, mayhem in the world. In reality, it's just how humans raise these animals in feedlots, and, you know, we take them off a natural diet.
Well, there were a couple of listener comments that came in after yesterday's program. You're listening to Radioactivity on WMNF in Tampa. Yesterday in Washington, Senate Democrats took a first step toward passing a coronavirus relief bill with or without GOP support. The Senate voted 50-49 to proceed to a budget resolution that greenlights passing a separate coronavirus relief bill through reconciliation, avoiding a 60-vote legislative filibuster. The filibuster stands in the way of Democrats' hopes in Washington, where they do have a majority in the House, but only a narrow majority in the Senate. And with the filibuster in place, Senate Democrats will have to keep their members in line and add at least 10 Republicans to support and pass any major legislation. How does the filibuster work? Where does it come from? And could it be done away with so that a simple majority of votes in the Senate would be enough to pass legislation? We're going to talk with Adam Gentleson, who is a former deputy chief of staff to Democratic Senator Harry Reid, and he is the author of a new book called Kill Switch: The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. And I spoke with him yesterday. Adam Gentleson, welcome to WMNF. Thank you for coming on the program.
Thanks for having me.
I want to start by asking what may be an obvious question, but where did the filibuster come from? Because as long as I've been around, the filibuster was there in the Senate. Is it part of the Constitution? Is it enumerated somewhere in the Constitution?
The answer is no. And I would also say that's not an obvious question, because the filibuster is something we've come to accept as normal, but it kind of snuck its way into existence in sort of a backdoor way. It was not part of the original Senate. And in fact, the framers, if someone had tried to introduce it at the time, the overwhelming body of evidence suggests that the framers would have opposed it because they went to great lengths to make the Senate a thoughtful and deliberative body, but they also went to great lengths to make sure that people were not able to obstruct in the Senate. They wanted debate to remain focused on issues at hand and focused on persuasion. They did not want debate to become used strictly for obstruction, which is what the filibuster does. You use it, you know, to give a long speech or today to simply make it harder to pass bills by raising the number of votes it requires to pass them. But that kind of obstruction is what the framers tried to prevent. They were writing the Constitution, of course, in the shadows of the Articles of Confederation. And one of the major problems with the Articles of Confederation had been obstruction in Congress. And so the framers went to great lengths to try to prevent that from happening in the Senate. The filibuster started to come into existence about 50 years after the creation of the Senate in the middle of the 19th century. And it started to come into existence because primarily because the slave power started to see that it was becoming outnumbered and outpowered in Congress. And so they needed a way to increase the power of their numerical minority that they represented in the Senate. And so the filibuster was created to serve that interest. For the first 100 years of its existence, all it could do was delay bills. You had to physically stand on the floor and talk, and that's what I think most of us think of when we think of the filibuster. We think of Jimmy Stewart and Mr. Smith Goes to Washington standing on the floor and physically holding the floor and giving a long speech. And that lasted for about 100 years, even more, maybe about 150. But then in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s, the filibuster started to evolve into something that didn't require anybody to talk. All you had to do was today send an email to your party leadership. And just by sending that email, you don't have to go on the floor. You don't have to give a speech. But you are able to do something even more powerful, which is to raise the number of votes it takes to pass a bill. For the first 200 years or more of the Senate's existence, it took a simple majority to pass a bill. Today, this new sort of stealth silent filibuster allows you to raise the threshold from 50 in a 100-member body, which is a majority, 51, to 60. It wasn't part of the original Senate. It became this talking filibuster, and today it has become something entirely different and is the primary source of gridlock in the federal government.
Mm. Jimmy Stewart would be outraged, I think, or Frank Capra would be outraged because Jimmy Stewart went through all that pain in Mr. Smith Goes to Washington. So the Senate simply rewrote the rules in the 19th century at the behest of the southern states, the slaveholding states.
Well, you know, what's interesting about it is it was actually, there was a loophole that they exploited. John C. Calhoun, who was the senator from South Carolina starting in the 1830s until his death in the 1850s, there used to be a rule in the original Senate that allowed a majority of senators to vote to end debate. So the idea was when it was clear that a debate had veered from attempts at persuasion into obstruction, a majority of the Senate could come together and say, all right, guys, let's wrap it up. This debate has gotten out of hand. Let's end debate and then bring the bill up for a vote. In 1806, obstruction was so rare that when the Senate was rewriting its rule books and sort of cleaning them up, it eliminated this rule because it was never used. It was considered beneath the dignity of senators to obstruct. So this rule to end obstruction was never used, and it was deemed superfluous, so they got rid of it. It took another 30 years for Calhoun to realize this presented a loophole, and that because there was no actual formal way to end debate, he could start talking for as long as he wanted, and he could coordinate with allies to sort of delay and hold the floor in this talking filibuster that we're familiar with. So the Senate didn't actually decide or make an affirmative decision as a body that it wanted to allow this. It created a loophole that was then able to be exploited. And that's sort of the history of the filibuster, is that it wasn't ever an affirmative decision. The Senate sort of backed into it through a bunch of unintended consequences. The same is true of the ability to raise it to 60-vote threshold today. This was never an affirmative decision. The Senate introduced a rule in 1917 that, similar to the rule that was eliminated in 1806, was supposed to be able to help people end debate. But over about a century, that rule was repurposed to become this 60-vote threshold. But there was never an affirmative decision by the Senate to say, we think that votes should now, the bill should now require 60 votes to pass. There was innovation by obstructionists that sort of led us to this point.
So how many votes in the Senate would it take to undo the filibuster rule to say, we're just going to do away with the filibuster? How many votes would that take?
Well, this is the good news, which is that it only takes a majority to change the rules and to reform the filibuster. This reflects the principle that the Senate is an ever-evolving institution. It has changed its own rules and altered them many times over the course of its existence. It has deployed this method of changing the rules, of using a majority vote to change them, at least 18 times in recent decades. So this is something that's been used before and is fully precedented. And this reflects the idea that the Senate, if a majority of the body decides it wants to alter its rules, it can do so. The Senate is designed to change and evolve as times go on and to adjust to the times that it lives in. I think there was a time when the filibuster may have served a purpose and may have been useful and not abused. But now that it's being abused, to me it makes perfect sense for the Senate as an evolving body that changes with the times, just like any other institution, to adjust its rules to this new reality and to take away this tool that has been using, that is being used by obstructionist numerical minorities to bring gridlock to the federal government.
We're talking with Adam Gentleson. He's the Public Affairs Director at Democracy Forward and a former Deputy Chief of Staff to Senator Harry Reid. And his book is called Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. And this is WMNF in Tampa. You mentioned something a moment ago. You mentioned stealth filibuster. Does that mean that the person who is sparking the filibuster doesn't have to reveal who he or she is?
That's exactly right. And I think this is part of what's become so insidious about the filibuster. You know, it used to be that if you were going to go through the trouble of filibustering a bill, you know, and this is, you know, the idea behind this is that this bill has majority support and is going to pass, and you are, you know, going through the effort to block it. So if you wanted to do that, you had to go to the floor and you know, explain your reasons and explain to people why you wanted to block something that was otherwise going to pass. And I think that's a reasonable thing to expect. Now you don't have to do that. You can send an email. And when I say send an email, I mean this literally. And I also mean that your staff can send it. Any member of the senator's staff can simply send an email to their party's leadership and say, I intend to filibuster this bill. And it's that intention that raises the threshold from a majority, where it used to be for the vast majority of the Senate's existence, up to 60 votes. And you never have to reveal to the public who it is that's sending that email, who it is that's raising that objection. They don't have to explain their reasons. They simply get to make it harder to pass a bill, and that is why it's being deployed so often. Mitch McConnell sort of seized on this ease of use in this new filibuster to deploy it far more than anybody had ever deployed it before against Barack Obama when he was president from starting in 2009. But that ease of use and that lack of transparency, I think, is a bad combination, because if bills are being blocked, the public deserves to know why. And the person blocking it should have to explain themselves. And right now in the Senate, supposedly the world's greatest deliberative body, this doesn't happen.
So if you're making the case that the filibuster is anti-democratic, how did things like the Civil Rights Bill in the mid-1960s or Medicare under LBJ at the same time period, or even Obamacare, how did they pass if the filibuster is anti-democratic?
Well, the Civil Rights Bills, it took them about 100 years to pass. I think what's important for people to understand is that Civil Rights Bills could have passed decades before the first Southern filibuster against them was finally broken in 1964. We celebrate that moment in 1964. We celebrate the passage of that bill because it was a historic moment in our history. But the sort of darker reality of it is that for decades, civil rights bills were passing the House, were coming over to the Senate, where they had a majority support and could have passed, and they had presidents of both parties ready to sign them. And the filibuster blocked those bills from passing. Starting in the 1920s, America was ready to start passing bills to combat lynching. Starting in the 1930s, we were ready to pass bills to end poll taxes. Starting in the 1940s, we were ready to pass bills to end workplace discrimination. But all of these bills were blocked for decades simply because a minority of senators in the Senate, almost exclusively from the South, forged this new tool to block them. So while it's great and laudable that we passed bills in 1964, it's also depressing to think about the cost of inhuman suffering that was incurred by failing to pass bills for up to 40 years before that. So I think it is anti-democratic. If the system had been more democratic, we would have passed civil rights bills, even under Republicans. The irony of this is that, you know, for many years during that period, the Republican Party was far more progressive than Democrats on civil rights. So, you know, our history could have been, you know, the Eisenhower administration was very aggressive on civil rights. We could have had civil rights bills passing under Republicans. Our history could be very different right now. But the filibuster alone was responsible for this 87-year delay. On Medicare, what's interesting about that is that there was no requirement that Medicare secure more than 50 votes. It ended up passing with north of 60 votes in favor of it and is lauded rightly as a bipartisan achievement. But what the filibuster shows is that the filibuster is not the mechanism that creates bipartisanship. Medicare never faced a filibuster. It passed on a simple majority basis. It secured broad bipartisan support because it was going to pass. And I think something that we would see if we got rid of the filibuster in the Senate today is you would start to see more bipartisanship when things were actually passing. Because if you take away the ability of the party that's out of power to throw a monkey wrench into the system, and you say, look, we'd love to have you on board, but we're going to pass this bill with or without you, you change the incentive structure. And so instead of having the incentive to be able to block you, they say, well, gee, this bill's going to pass. I might as well get on board. I will get credit for passing it because it's a popular bill, like Medicare. And if I get involved, I can have a chance to influence the direction of the policy in the direction I want to see it go. And Medicare is a great example of that. Once it became clear this bill was going to pass, it started to rack up bipartisan support. We need to see the gears of legislation turning again and actually see the federal government get back to legislating and not doing everything through executive actions or through the courts, but actually passing laws like it should. And I think that will be the conditions that facilitate more bipartisanship.
So did the power of the filibuster play a role in the Republicans standing up to President Obama in the last year of his office and blocking Merrick Garland's nomination to the U.S. Supreme Court? And did it play a role in the Republicans reversing themselves on whether or not you could nominate a Supreme Court justice in an election year?
Well, it certainly played a role in most of the obstruction that Republicans threw at President Obama. It was a major factor in Mitch McConnell, as Senate Majority Leader, deployed the Senate Minority Leader when they're out of power, deployed it far more than anybody had ever done before. When Garland was blocked, Republicans were the Senate majority, so Democrats were in the minority, and it wasn't the filibuster that they used to block Garland. McConnell simply refused to bring him up for a vote. I would argue, though, that because at that time, Supreme Court justices required 60 votes, it was a lot easier for McConnell to block Garland. The Senate was narrowly split at the time. Republicans had 53 seats to Democrats 47. So the fact that Garland needed to get all the way up to 60 votes, you know, if you had started 47 Democrats, that means 13 Republicans would have had to cross over if he'd been able to get a vote. That made it a much higher hill to climb. If Democrats had only needed to pick off three or four Republicans to confirm Garland, I think the dynamics of that episode would have been very different. It would have been much harder for Mitch McConnell to keep his Republicans in line behind his extreme maneuver if only three had to break away. When 13 had to break away, it made his job a lot easier to block Garland. So I think that is an example of how the filibuster, even when it's not the actual tool being deployed, has created an overall dynamic in the Senate where it is far easier to wage obstruction, and it creates an impossible burden on the side that's trying to get things passed. I also think that, you know, it was a huge factor in the 5 years previous to that, or some rather 7 years previous to that, where Republicans ground the gears of government to a halt on virtually everything the Democrats tried to do.
Mm. Adam Gentleson is the author of Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy, and this is 88.5 FM. So, Adam, you think it's a good idea that that Democrats, who are now in a one-vote majority in the U.S. Senate with the help of the vice president's vote, should change the rules? Can they do that? And have you talked to them? Has Chuck Schumer read your book? Have you talked to those folks about doing this? And what's the upside? What's the downside?
Yeah, I don't know if Senator Schumer has read my book. He's very busy, so I would not be insulted if he had that. I do talk to folks on the Hill still, and I think that there is a strong sentiment in favor of filibuster reform among Senate Democrats. I think that the vast majority of the 50 Democrats in the Senate want to reform the filibuster. There are a few holdouts. There's sort of one group that says, let's wait and see if Republicans block everything we want to do. And if they do, we will probably come around to filibuster reform. And then there's a group that's even more strongly opposed. It's probably only about two or three senators who have said they would not reform the filibuster, or who have said they would not eliminate the filibuster under any condition. And what I think is important there, and so I would say Democrats, you know, if the vote was called today, Democrats would be anywhere between 5 to 7 votes shy. But I think what's going to happen is that it's going to become inevitable, because Republicans are going to continue to obstruct everything that Democrats want to do. We're seeing this play out right now on the COVID relief bill, where President Biden has proposed exactly what economists say is necessary to revive our economy and exactly what health experts say is necessary to bring the pandemic under control. And Republicans have responded with an insulting counteroffer that's less than a third of what Biden has proposed. And I think that what's clear is Republicans have the same incentives that they have always had to block Democrats when they're in power. This is simply a function of our polarized political environment, where the party out of power will be more interested in making the party in power look bad and fail to deliver on their promises, so that the party out of power can get back into power in the very next elections. It's a sad reality that this is what it's come to, but that's where we are. And so I think the fact that Democrats are going to continue to run into Republican obstruction is going to force this question of filibuster reform. And at that point, I think even the very reluctant senators, like Senators Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, are going to come around and say, look, we are not going to stand in the way of the success of the Biden administration. We trust Joe Biden. He has a long history in the Senate. If anybody could have facilitated bipartisan compromise, it was him. But that's simply not possible. And at the end of the day, we're going to choose delivering results and saving the economy and getting this pandemic under control over these outdated traditions that have changed many times over the decades and are right to change now, because they've ceased to serve a productive purpose, and therefore they should be reformed.
So what happens when the pendulum swings back, though, and the Republicans regain control of the U.S. Senate, as they tend to do in modern American times? And if there's a structural problem with the U.S. Senate, that is that it tends to lean towards smaller states and rural states, you've got places like Utah and Idaho and Montana and Wyoming. A lot of conservative states have two U.S. senators. Even though you do have liberal states like Rhode Island that have some power in the Senate, but it's predominantly the rural states like West Virginia that have outsized power compared to the number of people who live in their state. Isn't there a structural problem that in the future the Senate leans to the right, will lean to the right, and you've given more power to Republicans?
Yeah, that's a good point. I'm glad you brought it up. So I have two responses to that. One is, one of the things that Democrats can do if they eliminate the filibuster is pass very important democracy reforms that will rebalance some of the structural tilt to the right. And these are things like statehood for areas that are currently bound by federal law but are not currently have no say in making those laws, so basically are living under taxation without representation. And those are areas like the District of Columbia, which is a overwhelmingly African-American city that currently has no power to govern itself, or Puerto Rico, which if it were to become a state, would be larger than 20 states. And certainly deserves that if they choose. So I think you can, you know, part of the imbalance towards Republicans would be addressed by things like expanding representation to areas that they currently deserve it. There are voter, you know, a lot of the tilt towards Republicans comes from voter suppression, and we can't fix that if the filibuster is in place. Republicans will always block and filibuster bills to end voter suppression. If we get rid of the filibuster, we can pass democracy reforms that will extend the vote to millions more people and start to rebalance the system there. The other thing that I would say about the structural tilt is that it's not as bad as you might think when you first look at it, because if you look at the 10 least populous states, they're actually evenly split between Democrats and Republicans, because as you mentioned, for every North Dakota or Wyoming, there is a Vermont or a Rhode Island or a Delaware or a New Hampshire that have two Democratic senators. And you know, what's interesting is if you flip it around the other side, the same is true of the most populous states. For every California and New York, there's a Texas or a Florida that also have two Republican senators. The real tilt towards Republicans actually comes from the Sun Belt. That is where they've been dominant. But the good news there is the Democrats have really started to become competitive there. We currently hold both seats in Georgia, and we've shown that we can be competitive in states like North Carolina, Florida, and even potentially South Carolina. So I think that the structural tilt can be sort of addressed by a suite of reforms. And as long as Democrats continue to make progress in the Sun Belt, where the population growth in those states comes primarily from Democratic-leaning voters, even Texas has started to become competitive. I think that it is a risk worth taking, because the things that we can pass if we get rid of the filibuster will provide insurance against Republican dominance. And I think you can rely on demographic growth to continue to advantage Democrats in these critical areas. The other thing I would point out is that, you know, there's a lot of fear of this whiplash effect of, you know, things swinging wildly back and forth. I think that fear is overblown, for the simple reason that that is how the Senate existed for the first 200 years of its existence, and you didn't see this whiplash effect. It is also how every other modern democracy governs itself. Legislatures around the world are majority rule, and you don't see this whiplash effect. The anomaly is to have a supermajority threshold. That is the abnormal thing, and I think if you get rid of it, you'll simply see the party in power decide to pass things. I don't think you'll see the party out of power seek to repeal everything, because that's not a good use of their time. They'll just pass what they want to pass, and I think that's sort of what you should have in a democracy.
Adam, one last question for me, and that is, you're a longtime staffer on Capitol Hill. Is there a window, is there a time frame that the Democrats would have to accomplish repeal of the filibuster between now and the 2022 elections? Is there a timeline that they have to do it by and beyond which they won't be able to do it?
There's no official timeline. They can do it as long as they hold the majority. Anytime between now and the elections in 2022. Hopefully they hold the majority from my perspective in 2022, but you never know. But there is sort of a political timeline, which is that after a certain point, you know, you start to lose momentum, you start to lose altitude, you know, there will be some new scandals that crop up, you know, some new issues that take the focus off of this. So I think one of the things we learned from the Obama administration, where we allowed Republicans to sort of string us along on healthcare negotiations for the entire first year of Obama's term, is that we should strike while the iron is hot. So in my mind, the sort of unofficial deadline is the summer. Congress always goes on this month-long recess in the month of August. And in 2009, that was the month-long recess where the Tea Party emerged and there were protests across the country, and it completely changed the political calculus. So I don't think you want to leave for the August recess with this stuff undone, because you never know what can happen after that, and there's a very strong chance you lose all of your momentum. So there's no official timeline, but there is sort of a political timeline, and to me that deadline is the end of the summer.
Adam, thanks for answering my questions, but what should I have asked you? Is there anything else you'd like to point out about this debate over the filibuster that you want our listeners to know?
Yeah, I think what I'd like to point out is that, you know, we talked a little bit about how the filibuster sort of came into existence through, you know, a desire to preserve slavery and the continued oppression of Black Americans during the Jim Crow era. And a lot of times people say, okay, well, that was how it came into existence, but what about now? And the thing I'd like to point out is that while it may not be used explicitly to maintain white supremacy as it was in the past, what's important to note is that the way the filibuster operates is that it continues to give power to the entrenched forces of the status quo, and it is overwhelmingly more useful as a tool of obstruction to conservative reactionaries than it is to liberals. Liberals like to pass things. They like to get things done. They like to pass big sweeping legislation to expand the social safety net, to expand civil rights, those sorts of things. Conservatives, in William F. Buckley's famous phrase, are the party that stands athwart history yelling stop. And so obstruction is simply more useful to them than it is to liberals. And I think it's important to keep that imbalance in mind as we go forward. I'm sure that in a reformed Senate, Republicans will find it to their advantage occasionally. But on balance, this kind of reform that allows legislation to actually pass will benefit liberals and progressives overwhelmingly more than it will benefit conservatives.
Adam Gentleson, thanks a lot. Thanks for the history lessons. Great to talk with you about your new book, Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. Thanks for coming on WMNF.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, that was Adam Gentleson, and he spells his last name Gentleson. He's currently the Public Affairs Director for Democracy Forward, and he's the former Deputy Chief of Staff to Democratic Senator Harry Reid, who was the President of the Senate, or the Senate Majority Leader, rather. And the book is called Kill Switch, The Rise of the Modern Senate and the Crippling of American Democracy. If you want to comment about what Adam said over the last 27 minutes or so, you can email us here in the studio. The address is dj@wmnf.org. We've gotten a few emails in. Gary writes from somewhere out there. Gary writes in to say, I have an idea for the Republican senators refusing to unify around a bill to help all Americans. The states that the Republicans represent should not get any of the stimulus bill. That could save some money, too. That should appeal to their fiscally responsible side and see how that goes over with their constituents, writes Gary. And then Jeff writes, in current times, it seems like a filibuster is a tool used to point fingers at the other side in order to prevent getting things done, which might actually help ordinary people. It seems things that benefit the rich go through a lot more easily without much resistance, writes Jeff. Well, we are going to open up the phone lines, too, and take your phone calls. I can read some more emails. If you want to send yours in, you can send it to dj@wmnf.org. And you can call us at 813-239-9663. Jessica Green is producing the phones today. And I'm going to bring up a few more things that we might talk about. And then let's see where you want to take the conversation. And again, our phone number is 813-239-9663. Email address is dj@wmnf.org. House Democrats in Washington say the Senate should convict former President Trump and bar him from future office because he endangered the lives of all members of Congress when he aimed a mob of supporters like a loaded cannon toward the U.S. Capitol last month. Trump's lawyers deny that he incited rioters and called the upcoming Senate trial unconstitutional. Both sides filed their legal briefs yesterday in advance of next week's trial. The Democrats forcefully linked Trump's baseless efforts to overturn the results of the presidential election to that deadly riot at the Capitol, saying that he bears unmistakable blame. Trump's lawyers rejected those charges and said that the Senate cannot put him on trial now that he has left the White House. Tampa Electric plans to ask regulators for a rate increase to cover new solar projects. In the Tampa Bay Times this morning, the article says, if approved, customers' rates will increase up to 18% from this year. The Tampa Bay Times reports Tampa Electric is currently on track to generate 14% of its power from solar over the next 2 years, the highest percentage of any of the state's for-profit power companies. Tampa Electric is building more than 1,200 megawatts of solar power by 2023, which will provide enough energy to power 200,000 homes. The coronavirus pandemic in the U.S. has been chiefly driven by young and middle-aged people, while the disease kills mostly older people. According to a new study in the journal Science, adults aged 20 to 49 were responsible for the vast majority of coronavirus transmissions last year. Three-quarters of new infections originated from adults 20-49 as of August of last year. In October, after a large portion of U.S. students returned to school, this age group was still responsible for about 72% of new infections. And again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Cable news has never been more in vogue and more competitive. The Nielsen Company says several CNN and MSNBC shows scored their best months in ratings ever. CNN as a whole had its best month in history in January, while MSNBC beat Fox News in prime time for the first time in more than 20 years. It was the first time Fox News had finished third in primetime ratings since 1999. Fox has led in the ratings for 19 years. With a more typical week just last week, Fox returned to its first in primetime. But the general trends continued with that network losing viewers, and CNN and MSNBC are picking up viewers. Florida Republican lawmakers are taking aim at Twitter, Facebook, and other tech giants because of limits on what people can post on the internet. Governor Ron DeSantis yesterday accused the companies of targeting conservatives as the companies crack down on social media posts that call for violence or spread falsehoods. Proposals before Florida's Republican-controlled legislature would seek to limit big tech's ability to disable or suspend a person's account. One bill being considered in Tallahassee, following President Trump's spurring of that insurrection at the U.S. Capitol, the proposal would allow Florida consumers and the state attorney general to sue the social media companies. Here's a little bit of Governor Ron DeSantis yesterday justifying this proposed legislation.
These platforms have changed from neutral platforms that provided Americans with the freedom to speak to enforcers of preferred narratives. Consequently, these platforms have played an increasingly decisive role in elections and have negatively impacted Americans who dissent.
That's Governor Ron DeSantis yesterday suggesting that there should be some laws forcing the tech giants to accept all points of view. And I think that raises some interesting issues. What do you think? Our phone number, 813-239-9663. Our email address is dj@wmnf.org. And if you want to comment about anything you've heard here so far, you can call us up, 813-239-9663. Well, up in Washington, there's a big debate about the North Georgia Congresswoman Marjorie Taylor Greene. And yesterday, Utah Republican Senator Mitt Romney told reporters he agrees with Senate Republican leader Mitch McConnell that Congresswoman Greene's controversial statements and positions should be condemned by the GOP. Here's what Mitt Romney said yesterday to reporters.
I think our long history as a party has shown that it's important for us to separate ourselves from the people that are in the wacky weeds. And if we don't, that our opposition tries to brand us with their image and with their point of view, which is it has been detrimental to any party that doesn't do that.
That's Mitt Romney yesterday. Again, our phone number, 813-239-9663. Let's go to Kurt in Lakeland. Kurt, thanks for calling in. What would you like to comment about?
Rob, thank you for playing that clip with Ron DeSantis. I happened to catch that yesterday where he was talking about different platforms and that he understands and trusts Floridians to be able to digest and consume their information. And he also was the guy who used the FDLE to get into the home of the former Miami Herald reporter to, again, to try and change data on the Florida website. So it's interesting that he's talking about this, it's duplicitous, right? He's talking about these platforms and he trusts people to consume information, but yet he wants to be the curator of the information. So anyway, I just thought I'd point out the irony.
Yeah, it wasn't a Miami Herald reporter, though. It was Rebecca Jones, who did work for a time at the State Department of Health, and his FDLE raided her house looking for all sorts of computers and cell phones and that sort of thing. But you're right. I mean, the governor seems to want to shut down her information, doesn't he?
Yeah, it's interesting about this whole understanding of the voters of Florida and their ability to be smart enough to consume content. We could consume content, especially if it's honest. Why can't we weed through that? But are we too naive and too stupid that we only can see the content that he provides? Anyway, I just again, when it's talking about controlling content, controlling the speech of others, I just think that this is so duplicitous, and we shouldn't not mention what he did with Rebecca Jones in context of that clip that you played.
Yeah. All right. Kurt, thanks a lot. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
All right. You know, I'm curious. The Republicans are saying that they're being censored. This is the word that they use about these private corporations having some standards about when it comes to issues of violence or claiming that there was a stolen election. The social media companies have kind of stepped in and policed some of that. Some of it gets through, too. But I'm wondering, you know, in the classic, in the true definition of censorship, it means the government is preventing people from expressing their views. And I'm just wondering, when Governor DeSantis or other conservatives use this word censorship, they're really talking about what corporations do every day. In your workplace, if you work for a corporation, there's some things you can hang on the wall and some things you can't. The corporation has limits on how you can dress sometimes, and the corporation has limits on what you can say at work. But this is not censoring you as much as it is. It's the power of the corporation. And there's got to be a better word for the power of the corporation than censorship, because censorship involves the government. And you hear a lot of Republicans complaining that they're being censored, yet they have access to the media every day. They control a giant amount of media in this country. Let's go to Phil in Sarasota. Phil, thank you for calling. What would you like to say?
Hi. Hi. I am a conservative-leaning independent, so just to give you where I'm coming from in this, my feeling about Governor DeSantis' proposal for social media to be forced to hear all points of view, I do think that, you know, we used to have this fairness doctrine, even on the radio, that if you were going to have one point of view, you had to balance it by the other point of view. I think there's some legitimacy to wanting to hear both sides of everything, and we have kind of slipped down a slippery slope where there are certain radio stations or television stations or whatever that are, we think of now as exclusively one view or another. And I don't think that's particularly good, but having said that, I do think that there is a limit that should be placed on people's points of view. When it comes to the point of promoting insurrection, promoting violence, promoting child pornography, there are all kinds of things that you could promote that I think those social media units should be able to regulate and absolutely limit. Whether they should be allowed to limit points of view just because they don't agree with that point of view, I'm not so sure about that, because even though they are, they're not really regulated by the FCC, it's kind of like cable television, you can sort of say what you want to say, I do think that there should be some societal regulation of what is balanced and what is allowed to be said.
You know, Phil, I'm not sure, and you tell me, I'm not sure that the governor's made the case that just a simple conservative point of view is being censored on Facebook or Instagram or Twitter. I don't, you know, and now I haven't talked to the governor, and he's probably not going to return my phone call if I call him. But I don't know if he's made that case. I think what my understanding of it is, and maybe you can correct me, is that my understanding is that what Facebook and Twitter have done is if somebody posts a statement saying that the election was stolen, they sometimes flag it and say this contains incorrect information, or perhaps they take it down, although I don't think that happens very often. But it's not as if it's not as if just simple points of view are being blocked. Now, I could be wrong, because I can tell you that we tried to buy an ad from Facebook last year this would be a commercial thing, to talk about a speech that we were going to sponsor by a businessman who thinks that single payer is a good idea. And this is a really successful manufacturer from Pennsylvania who came down to St. Petersburg last year for our behalf and gave a speech. And Facebook blocked us from buying that ad. But I don't know if they've actually blocked content based on, you know, let's say that you want to say tax cuts are good. Does Facebook ever block that?
I don't, you know, I agree with you. I don't think either the governor has made that case, or I don't think social media is doing that. What I think social media has kind of gotten into this, they've jumped into the foray about the election being thrown, and I actually appreciate the fact that they're flagging notes. If people can believe whatever they want to believe about a case, you know, somebody could say, well, somebody was arrested, but I don't believe they're guilty. Well, you know, that's their belief. And there are people out there who believe that the election was thrown, despite all the cases against it and the fact that there's no evidence to show that it is. They can still make that case. And I do appreciate fact-checking. I appreciate fact-checking. What I don't appreciate is two things. On the one side, just having the ability to, I wouldn't call it censoring either, because I do think that's government, but having the ability to delete something because either the radio, television, or social media disagrees with that point of view. Or the second thing is allowing, on the other end of it, allowing things to be said, like Parler and Gab and some of these others were allowing, you know, come on down, we're going to burn it. We're going to burn it to the ground. We're going to, you know, we're going to take out this senator and that congressman and, you know, bring your guns and all that. I mean, that incitement of violence or insurrection or overthrow or whatever it is, you know, it's the same thing with pornography, child pornography. You know, come on down, bring your kids. No, I think all of that stuff ought to be regulated, not only regulated, but deleted from those organizations. But other than that, and I don't think it's happening, actually, other than that.
Yeah, I agree with you. I don't think it is. Now, I'm going to listen. We're going to pay close attention to the debate in Tallahassee over this proposed bill, but I don't think that just simply saying that you're in favor of tax cuts or you want limited government, that those points of view are being censored.
No.
On social media, yeah. All right, Phil, thanks a lot. Thank you for the call. I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
All right, thank you. You know, the other question I have, too, is, you know, if social media is allegedly censoring conservatives, let me ask you this. I mean, we have a really strong and thriving conservative media industry in this country. We've got websites and Breitbart, and we've got YouTube channels, and we've got InfoWars, and we have lots of cable news outlets, the Fox News outlet, the One America News outlet, talk radio, which, you know, in most cities like Tampa, there's three or four places on the dial, usually on the AM dial, where you can hear 24 hours a day conservative speakers, which is okay. But then my question is, are liberals being censored in those media outlets? For instance, when you watch Sean Hannity at night, does he let liberals talk? Or when you listen to talk radio, Mark Levin or Rush Limbaugh, does he give liberals, you know, 5 minutes or 6 minutes to talk? And do liberals feel like they're being censored by talk radio? Or by do they feel that they're being censored by One America News? When I watch One America, I don't see liberals on there. And is that censorship? In the same sense that Ron DeSantis and other conservatives are using the term censorship. It's not the classic definition because that talk radio station is a private business. Fox News is a private business. But if conservatives are saying private businesses like Facebook are discriminating against conservatives, then could you also say the same thing about talk radio? Let's go to Patty in Sarasota. Patty, thank you for calling. What would you like to say?
I totally agree with your last caller. And I think also what you just said about allowing liberals to speak. Of course, they're not liberals. I kind of hate the word liberal, and I hate the word conservative. I think there's middle. And I think that that right there, we, you know, sort of paint a symbol on people. And definitely, DeSantis needs, I don't know if anybody can approach him, but what you all were just talking about, if I was to put on my Facebook that I'm effing angry about what's her name, Marjorie Greene or whatever, and I'm going to go down, and would anybody like to join me down at Sarasota City Hall to protest, and if you do have a gun, bring it. I would say if I was off my rocker, I would love it if my friend or Facebook took it down. So I think most people...
Because you would admit you crossed the line by saying that.
Even if I was insane, okay, Facebook should take that down. Hey, I got a great kiddie porn website or whatever. And they're not going to do that because they will get caught. But the bottom line is whitewashing. It's like the people that said, well, you know, they protested all summer long and burnt buildings and everybody's upset with Trump. Oh, yeah, we are. Because it's just dumb American citizens going haywire with violence. Guess what? Different level for the so-called president. Apple, orange.
Yeah, it's one thing to and it wasn't all Black Lives Matter protesters. 99% of Black Lives Matter protesters were peaceful, and there were millions of people that took place in peaceful protests. But you're right. I mean, it's one thing to want to storm the Capitol and kill members of Congress, kill the vice president, and it's another thing to want to burn down a shoe store.
Well, people are not, whether it's DeSantis or any of our governmental leaders, and the people that support Trump, they won't see that because they want their way. So they have to do a generalizing. They want their own way, whether it's violent, whether it's Trump is king. And the only way to do that is say, well, you did that, like I know I am, but what are you kind of childish thing?
All right, Patty, thanks a lot. Thank you for that. 813-239-9663. Ellen Largo says, we need standards for the media very similar to Canada and the U.K., they banned Fox in 2014 and 2017, respectively, due to the untruths and propaganda. And Elizabeth, they don't have a First Amendment in the UK or Canada, and I wonder, would you want to repeal the First Amendment? I mean, certainly conservatives have a right to say things. I wish they didn't lie, and that's why we've got fact checkers, but should you ban Fox News in the U.S.? What do you think? Let's go to Steve in Tampa. Steve, thank you for calling. What would you like to say?
Yeah, Rob, I think the caller before the last one said a lot of what I wanted to say, but I do feel that that censorship really is simply censorship, whether it's the government or a private organization or a school or even another person telling you you can't, you know, look at this or that. Censorship is censorship, and although I think, you know,
if Facebook is saying, look, you can't spread the lie that the election was stolen on Facebook, would you call that censorship?
I'm afraid I would. I wouldn't agree with it, but I think they have a right to say whatever they want, and as long as it's not, you know, like how to make a bomb or kiddie porn, like you said, or stuff like that. If they want to say that, you know, half the members of Congress are reptilians secretly, I don't agree with it, but you know what? I wouldn't want to shut him down.
Steve, thanks a lot. Thanks for your thoughts. Great to hear from you. And let's go to, we're going to go to Peter in Tarpon Springs. Hey, Peter, you're on MNF. What's up?
Yeah, what you said earlier about censorship being from the government censoring us is true, but the thing I would say is most people who sign on to these Twitter, Facebook pages, to do that, you have to sign on and agree to terms of agreement. And most people don't read those terms of agreement. And in there, it does define that you can or cannot state certain things. So for the governor to say that they're being censored because of certain things they're saying, it's because people are not reading the terms of agreement that the companies have said this is what is allowed or is not allowed. So that was my point.
That's a great point. All right, Peter, thanks a lot. Thank you. Andy in Tampa writes, the issue isn't that conservative views are being targeted and silenced. It's that outright lies are being targeted and silenced. And the problem is that the two are often one and the same, writes Andy in Tampa. Well, if you want to comment about today's show, call us up, 813-238-8001 and extension 115. That's the comment line. And you can comment about today's program, and we'll play your comments back tomorrow. Stay tuned for NOLA. He's coming up next right here on 88.5 FM, WMNF, Tampa, St. Petersburg, Sarasota, and Lakeland. Thanks to Jessica Green. She's been our phone producer today. I'm Rob Lurie. This has been Radioactivity. And now let's go up to Washington, D.C. and get the latest news from NPR.